Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Ambibulous, a show where we discuss a variety of topics about alcohol. From beer styles, the brewing process, distillation and spirits, and even liquor laws, there's a fascinating world to discover. On today's episode, we talk about Trappist Monk beer. Joining me today is Dylan Schaefer, owner of Dialectic Brewing Company here in Mandan, North Dakota. I'm your host, Connor Brecky. Let's all raise a glass to the Ambibulous. Welcome back, everyone, to another wonderful episode of the Ambibulous. I'm back at Dialectic Brewing with Mr. Dylan Schaefer. Thank you for joining me again.
Absolutely.
And then we are going to touch up on an episode we previously did about Belgian ale. We're going to do a spin-off on that about Trappist beer. It's a very interesting style of beer. It's actually fortunate that the United States actually has a Trappist monastery that brews accredited Trappist beer. So we will be trying that style from Spencer Brewing out of Massachusetts today on the show. So let's get into it. Trappist beer. In short, Trappist beer is basically just brewed by Trappist monks. I mean, that's the short story. Historically, it's been pretty much just for the monks and people who visit. Now it's kind of blown up into other things, but we'll get into that shortly. Currently, there are 14 monasteries, 6 in Belgium, 2 in the Netherlands, 1 each in Austria, Italy, England, France, Spain, and of course the US. And then we can currently produce accredited Trappist beer as per the International Trappist Association, ITA.
Yeah, and us having one here in the U.S., we are kind of an outlier because these Trappist monasteries and Trappist beers tend to be very regionally specific. So having one in the Northeast in the U.S. is, we're kind of an outlier, but it's a good thing we have it.
It is a very cool thing. I would figure that of all the places, why not the U.S. with such a massive beer scene and everything? It's fairly new, too.
Beer scene and, a Catholic and religious scene as well. So it is rather fitting that we do have one.
So as of 2021, Arkel is one of the Trappist breweries. It is no longer considered a Trappist brewery because there's no more monks. They ran out of monks. The monks are gone. They're all gone.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, I think there were like 2 monks that in 2021 or shortly before that had moved and relocated to a different monastery, and therefore they lose that accreditation.
So the history of Trappist beer, it's Catholic Trappist order. It originated in the Cistercian monastery of La Trappe, France. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong because I don't have a French accent, but
that's how I'd say it. So
it sounds about right. So various Cistercian congregations have existed for a while. By the 1600s, the abbot of La Trappe felt that the Cistercians were becoming a little bit on the liberal side, so he instituted a series of rules, the strict observance, but since then it's kind of been relaxed and it's kind of gone by the wayside. I mean, these breweries, I guess you would call them brew houses or like little local brew hamlets or something, have been around since the Middle Ages. It's been a thing for a while. The Trappist order spread from France to the rest of Europe around then. So they originally pretty much just brewed to feed themselves and the community. Nowadays, it's a whole different thing. It's going to charity. It's going for, I got a bottle of it from Spencer. So it's more, I guess you say capitalized right now. But yeah, that's kind of the brief history of it in short.
Well, as you mentioned too, traditionally, this beer was brewed for consumption on the monastery. And a big part of that was during Lent, Trappist monks would fast. So they were not allowed to consume any solid food during Lent. The way that they would supplement that solid food, get their calories and get their sustenance was through drinking the beer that they brewed. There's actually been a few people in the United States who did that exact experiment. Say, hey, can I survive on no solid food and, drinking water, drinking beer and other non-solid food options? Can I survive on that for the entire season of Lent? And it is very viable. So that was a huge aspect of them originally creating beer for the monastery, was it was a sustenance-based thing. It was a good way to get their calories, their protein, their carbs. You could get all of that without consuming solid food during the fast season.
We all know nowadays beers are pretty high in calories, but imagine what they were like back then when it was basically survival.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, very unfiltered, raw, higher alcohol, higher malt content beers.
And as with a lot of things in Europe, the 1900s was kind of a rough time. Unfortunately, a lot of these monasteries and breweries were destroyed or rendered unusable during the world wars, and they've been kind of making a comeback since then. So come about 1990 or so, there's about 8 Trappist abbeys that founded the ITA, International Trappist Association, basically to prevent non-Trappist commercial entities from kind of taking advantage of the Trappist name. You don't want like somebody, oh, look, I know my cousin's brother's aunt's nephew's uncle is a monk, so I'm going to make a Trappist beer.
And that was the case for, you know, for quite a few years up until 1997, and this association was founded. There were a bunch of brewers over in Europe releasing Trappist beers that had a good, Trappist beer in general has a good marketing point. And a lot of breweries were capitalizing on that marketing despite not really having any tie to Trappist beer at all.
And then we'll kind of touch on that a bit later in the episode with Abbey beer, but for now we're just going to kind of go through Trappist beer. So Trappist beer has some categories that you have to follow as per the ITA. So one of them being the beer has to be brewed within a Trappist monastery. It's got to be either by the monks or under strict supervision of the monks, but either way, it has to be actually brewed within the walls of said monastery. The brewery can't be like the primary purpose that the monastery is there. You can't just build a monastery and fill it with a brewery and go from there. It's supposed to be a traditional monastery. It's traditional monastic way of life. There, you know, it can't be just like a front. And then the brewery is not supposed to be a profit-making venture at all. The income's supposed to just cover the living expenses of the monks and the maintenance of the building and upkeep, grounds, what have you. Whatever's left over needs to be donated to charity or social work or the community or, you know, basically to help either the monastery or the community. And then as of 2021, I believe Belgium only has 5 Trappist beers left.
Yeah, and there are some Trappist brewers out there that are largely following these traditions, but they don't necessarily have the accreditation. Again, things change. Maybe a bunch of the monks move. Maybe they lose their abbot or things like that. So there are several Trappist brewers over in Europe that don't hold the accreditation of the ITA because of some of these really strict stipulations that the ITA has.
So Trappist beer, as per the ITA, has all these certain restrictions, but there is another style that's related to Trappist beer called Abbey beer. Doesn't necessarily follow these strict criteria, and it's actually kind of more accessible for brewers interested in this style, but Dylan's got some information about that.
Yeah, so kind of generally speaking, Abbey beer is going to follow all of the same styles of a Trappist beer. However, it doesn't conform to some of these strict regulations like being brewed within the monastery itself. So Abbey beer largely became in kind of an offshoot of Trappist beer. Again, Trappist beer, you'll see your various styles of beer. You'll see those same styles of beer in Abbey ales, but they may not be brewed within the monastery. And especially because I'm guessing a lot of our listeners are going to be United States-based listeners. The United States and Belgium and Europe do view Abbey beer very differently. So in Belgium, that Abbey beer does still have to have some tie to a monastery or a monk or an abbot. It doesn't have to be a really concrete tie, but in Belgium, you do still have to have some tie to be marketing beer as an Abbey beer. However, in the United States, it's largely become a free-for-all. If you brew a beer that kind of follows these style guidelines, but none of the regulations, you can market it however you see fit. So, I mean, honestly, if someone wanted to brew a pale ale here and call it an Abbey ale, there's nothing stopping them from doing that. That being said, a lot of the brewers in the United States who brew Abbey ales, Belgian doubles, things of that nature, are following the traditional brewing practices and the traditional recipes and everything. Again, they just don't fall into all of the criteria of the Trappist beer.
Right. It's kind of relied on mutual respect and the honor system.
Yeah. And I mean, really, the whole idea was, again, to kind of prevent everyone out there under the sun from capitalizing on Trappist beer. Because as you mentioned, a big thing with Trappist beer is any money that didn't go to funding the monastery itself was donated to charity and stuff like that. People were willing to support that cause. However, if you can go out and just buy a beer that's a Trappist beer, but it's really just going into Joe Schmo's pocket as a profit, it's not really following those traditions of Trappist beer. So these Abbey ales, Abbey beers came about to kind of mimic the styles without following all the guidelines. And it was a way for the Trappist monks to kind of protect their name. So there were several, largely in the 1960s through the 1990s, there were several lawsuits that resulted from people claiming to be brewing Trappist beer that really wasn't Trappist beer. And that's where we started to see the creation of these Abbey beers start to pop up. Even in the United States, typically when you see an Abbey beer, it does still largely follow some criteria. It's almost always going to be a top fermented or warm fermented ale beer using a particular Belgian yeast strain and falling within the style guidelines of kind of let's say 3 to 4 main styles that Trappist breweries brew.
So yeah, touching up on how the Abbey beer is made, let's go through some of the methods for how a Trappist beer, it's very similar to like the Belgian ale style, since this is a spinoff of Belgian ale. So we have top fermented, we have different, systems and nomenclatures for the different beers. They have Inkle, single, double, a double, triple, quadruple. A lot of similarities, a lot of similar characteristics there.
And these names, so these, the Inkle, the Dubbel, the triple, the quadruple, these names largely came about when Trappist brewers started serving beer to the public or selling beer to other folks that were not specifically on the monastery. And a lot of these names came out as basically they were a warning label. So your traditional Abbey ale, your single, your Enkel was your base kind of percentage beer. For the Enkel, you're looking at anything that's, typically a sessionable beer. Again, for these monks during fast season, they still have all their daily tasks and everything that they need to do. So the Enkel was typically below 5% alcohol. It was a session beer. It was something that they could drink, they could get their calories, but they could still go out and do their daily tasks. Yeah. Then the double was basically, or the Dubbel was an amped up version of that. So you'll typically see those falling in the range from kind of 6 to 7% alcohol. And again, that name was a warning to consumers that, hey, this is stronger than a typical Trappist beer. The triple, kind of same story. This one's even stronger. It's usually 8 to 9% alcohol. And then all the way up to the quadruple. Again, this one really packs the punch and is usually going to be 10% alcohol and higher. I've personally seen them as high as 14, 15, 16% even. So those names largely came about as kind of a warning label to the consumer that, hey, this isn't your everyday beer. It's going to pack a little bit more of a punch.
Sometimes the monks just need a little extra kick.
Yeah.
I don't blame them at all.
So going along with kind of the names that they chose, the Dubbel, the triple, the quadruple, these also did have kind of specific guidelines for what type of beer it was going to be. So normally you'd see a single or the Enkel was going to be a more, light, easy drinking beer. The Dubbel switched things up and became a little bit more of a darker, maltier beer. You can think of it as kind of a high-gravity amber ale or a high-gravity brown ale. The triple kind of flip things around, and those are going to traditionally always be, again, a light beer. So in the darker beers, a lot of the times they would use kind of a dark Belgian candy sugar to bring out that dark, rich color and flavor. They frequently use that in the Dubbel. switching over to the Trippel, they would use a lighter Belgian candy sugar and keep the beer still a little bit lighter in color, kind of a nice golden hue, a little higher on the hop character, and again, higher alcohol. And then back to the quadruple was typically going to be going back to those dark Belgian candy sugars and a darker, heavier, fuller bodied beer. So we kind of see a flip-flop between dark ales, light ales, and your gradation of how strong it is, how high the original gravity is, and in turn, how high its overall alcohol percentage will be.
And touching up on strength, the current ale I have right now with me from Spencer is a 6.5%. The bottle is kind of, you know, it's a dark bottle, so I'm not entirely sure what it looks like, but we'll be tasting that shortly here. So check out our Facebook page, The Ambibulous Podcast, for another little video photo segment there. So I'd like to actually talk about this place real quick, the Spencer Monastery Trappist Ale. A little brief history on it. It's St. Joseph's Abbey of Massachusetts. It was founded in about 1950 or so on the former site of Alticrest Farms under leadership of Dom Edmund Futterer. Hopefully I said that name right. basically, the monks moved there from previous location in Rhode Island, which was damaged by a fire in the same year, roughly around the same time. So Father Thomas Keating was elected abbot of the Alley in 1961. And then jump ahead to 2010, St. Joseph's Abbey explored the possibility of making beer. It was kind of like one of those things that, like, hey, other places do it, so we should try it too. Basically, they sent people throughout these different monasteries, accredited monasteries, kind of like a beer mission, if you will. And including not just them, but like Belgian beer fests. Like there's one in Boston, there's different breweries in Europe, basically to figure out how do we do this traditionally, how do we do this properly, and how can we make it work. So all these different people went out and got all this information, and basically the recommendations came in. It was basically get a brewing engineer, somebody skilled, build a modern state-of-the-art facility, and then only brew one type of beer for the first 5 years. Brew it well, and learn, and then you can go from there. So basically, they made like 20-ish test batches or so. Then they finally chose the final recipe. And the first beer made was a blonde, 6.5%, called Spencer Trappist Ale. And I think that's what we're drinking right now. It just says Spencer Trappist Ale on it. So I'm going to go ahead and say that's probably what we're going to be drinking. So yeah, it was as of 2016, so fairly recent. It's the first and only certified Trappist brewery in the U.S. The complex, the brewery part of it, is about 3,600 square feet, or 36,000, excuse me, square feet, in a 50-barrel capacity. Its open house was August 6th of 2016 to about 2,500 visitors or so. And then as of 2018, the brewery is considering exploring, a tap room and something open year-round to kind of introduce people to the culture and history of this new style of beer that's popping up.
Yeah, and the Spencer is a really interesting one. They're relatively new to the game when it comes to Trappist brewing. The fact that they were really starting to brew beer, what was it, when did they put out their first one? 2015-ish, 2016, I think, right in that range. And needless to say, it wasn't that long ago that Spencer put out their first beer. So they are fairly new to the game in comparison to other Trappist breweries. However, they followed the Trappist tradition of doing it right.
Yes.
They wanted to pick one style and make sure they could do that style perfectly before they had ventured on to anything else. So they did their research. They brewed, like you said, 20-some batches before they were like, this recipe is where it needs to be. Now we can actually produce it. So again, credit where credit is due. The Trappist monks, they know how to make beer and they know how to do it right. When they do things, they are dedicated to what they do. And I'm very excited to try this beer, which is their flagship beer, and I'm sure it will not disappoint.
Yeah, and just to tell you guys how new this place is, I've got the list of them. All the ones from Belgium, 1836, 1838, 1863, 1899, 1931, and the one that's not accredited anymore because they ran out of monks, 1850. And I look at the U.S., it says 2013, Netherlands 2013, Italy 2015, England 2018, there's a French one 1826, and Austria 2012, and then a Netherlands one 1884.
And keeping in mind that these, you know, obviously we see a trend, the French and the Belgium ones are very early on in history because that is where a lot of this started and largely why the Trappist beers are an offshoot of Belgian beers.
Yes, there's a lot of cultural mingling there. French and Belgian are kind of, they have a history together.
Absolutely. And I mean, drawing back to our Belgian episode and relating to this episode a little bit, I mean, we're talking about a brewing history that existed long before these were like necessarily independent countries. I mean, I don't think Belgium gained, they didn't become an independent country until like 1830, if I'm not mistaken. So the brewing history in this region predates borders and predates the foundation of some of these countries. But again, we're really focusing on a style of brewing more so than just a particular country drawn out by really delineated lines, you know?
Right. Since the dawn of man, we've created a liquid and then fermented it and drank it. That, you know, that's beer. It's just evolved constantly throughout the ages. And this is no different. It's just a really unique style, I think, how it came to be.
Oh, absolutely.
And then with that, we're going to take a short break and try some of this Trappist beer. So stay tuned. Alrighty guys, we are back from a little break. Got ourselves some Spencer Trappist Ale. This stuff is really, it's really pretty. Kind of a slightly hazy, nice caramel color.
And that being said, a lot of the Belgian beers, Trappist beers, Abbey beers that you come across, a lot of that is going to be an unfiltered beer. You'll see a pretty substantial amount of haze in it, traditionally speaking. And it does, just that gorgeous kind of orangish, hay-colored. Yeah, just a beautiful beer.
Oh man, that smells really good too.
Yeah, you instantly get, right on the aroma, you instantly get the phenolics of that Belgian yeast in there for sure. Almost a little bite, like an orange peel, lemon peel kind of bite.
It's like a marmalade or something.
Yeah, definitely like kind of like an orange marmalade aroma to it. And just a really nice, consistent, cream-colored head on it. I believe that the head on a beer is a huge part of the experience of drinking a beer, and it presents beautifully. It's consistent.
I've never had this before. This is a first for me. Oh, wow. That's good.
Oh, it's so interesting too, because I get a lot of the phenolics on the aroma, and then the esters really come through on the flavor profile of it. So for the listeners who don't know what I'm referring to, the phenolics are going to be a little bit more of the kind of herbal and spicy characteristics that you get from the yeast. And then the esters, just another compound given off by yeast, is going to be a little bit more of the kind of fruity character that you get. And this, you just get the esters right on the nose and then fades beautifully over into those nice, fruity Belgian yeast esters in there.
And esters are actually, there is usually no fruit involved. It's just whatever the yeast does, it makes a compound and it gives you kind of a fruit-like notes to it. There's no actual fruit.
Yep, 100%. And it's kind of the same idea as when you drink like a Hefeweizen or something.
The banana.
The banana. Hefeweizens aren't brewed with bananas. It's just the ester from the yeast production gives it that character. And yeah, this one is just
a lot. There's definitely, the orangish taste to it.
A lot of orange yeast ester going on in there and really well balanced. It has bitterness. It has noticeable bitterness. However, it's not like drinking an IPA bitterness. It's just enough that it's, you know, it's
smooth.
There.
It's really smooth. Like, when you look at a beer like this and then you see that haziness, you kind of ought to, well, I do. I think to IPA and I think to bitter and I think to, this isn't the case. It's got kind of a spice kick.
Yep.
And then it smooths out really well. And then you get with that estery and the nose on it.
And it finishes those esters, those kind of orangey flavored, orange marmalade flavored esters, give it a little bit of a sweet midpoint to it. And then it just finishes off nice and crisp and dry. It's not overly sweet. It's not cloying at all. You just get a little bit of that orange sweetness in the middle and then a nice, dry, crisp finish on it.
I think I may have to order some more of this stuff.
I can recognize that it took them quite a few batches before they pinpoint where this was. Mm-hmm. And they finally said, hey, this is perfect. This is what we want to release.
Yeah.
Because it is very, very well done. I think the alcohol content, it's a very, very sweet spot. It's not necessarily a session beer that you're going to sit down and drink 10 or 15 of. It's something you can sit down. It has a lot of character. You can appreciate the character it has. It's also not 10% and going to ruin your day.
Right. Yep. It's in that middle ground. It's 6.5. So it's more than a session, but not quite like a heavy hitter.
And you know, and just my personal opinion and my personal taste, I really consider that anywhere between 6 and 7% in my mind is really the sweet spot for beer. You know, it's got some alcohol character to it, but it's not overpowering.
And then we do have some more. We got a Pilsner, we got the Wit, and then we have another darker ale, but we'll be doing segment on those a little later on. I'm really excited to try the other ones.
And I am kind of curious. I'm going to see if I can pinpoint based on the bottle here. Yeah, it does appear to be a bottle conditioned beer. So carbonation being done in the bottle itself. When the beer goes into the bottle, it still has some live yeast in there and a little bit of residual sugar. That yeast eats up that sugar and gives it its own natural carbonation. And I was guessing it had that nice bottle conditioned carbonation character just from drinking it. And you can see on the bottom of the bottle that it does have just the faintest little bit of residual yeast hanging out on the bottom down there. And for those of you who haven't had a bottle conditioned beer, I highly recommend seeking one out because it is a very different mouthfeel and carbonation than a force carbonated beer on just CO2 gas. It's smoother. It's still crisp, but it's just so much smoother and
it's a noticeable difference.
There's, absolutely.
I don't want to say it packs a punch, but there's something there that you taste and it's like, it'd be kind of like the difference between a flat beer and a carbonated beer. There's just that subtle difference there that forces that flavor and all that extra aroma into you. And this is really good.
And it maintains so well. I found that a lot of the bottle conditioned beer I've had, it just maintains its head and maintains its carbonation so well. A little bit of agitation and it's just got that nice, perfect white foam sitting on top again.
I don't think the camera is going to be able to pick this up, but...
Yeah, you really need like the perfect light, but you can see just that little bit of residual yeast in there. And anytime I see that in a bottle, that's a good sign to me. I know that it's going to be a bottle conditioned beer with that really... you know, a little bit heavier, creamier carbonation to it. And especially corked up with a champagne cork really keeps everything inside and the way it should be.
Just when you pour it.
Yes.
You can kind of see that it's not quite mixed up or there's like that little subtle carryover almost.
Yep. And again, it just, that beautiful head on there. Yeah. And you can almost see, I'm not sure if the camera will be able to tell, but obviously you kind of got the last pour of the beer. And it does, you know, darken up just a little bit as you start to pick up a little bit more of that yeast from the bottom of the bottle. And for those of you looking to go out and try a bottle conditioned beer, don't be afraid of that little bit of yeast dregs hanging out in the bottom of there. A lot of the times when I drink a bottle conditioned beer before I give the last pour, I'll just give the bottle a little bit of a swirl and agitate that yeast up into suspension. And it really contributes a nice, pleasing profile to the beer when you drink it.
Yes, definitely. Don't look at the beer and say, oh, there's stuff at the bottom. That's gross. No. That's good that it's there. It helps with this.
On a bottle conditioned beer, you want that there. It's awesome.
I want a candle of this. Like, honestly, I would have a beanpot candle of this, I think.
Yeah, I think one of the most amazing things to me on this beer is that the aroma and flavor profile are so different. You know they're coming from the same thing,
mm-hmm.
but you just get two. It's like you're drinking two different beers. The one you get on the nose, on the bouquet, and then the one that hits your palate. And that's the subtlety and the nuance that I was talking about earlier that is just, I love finding that in a beer. It's nothing that's overpowering, yeah. That's punching you in the face. It's just, it's subtle, but there's a lot going on. There's a lot of character. There's a lot to look for.
And you know, that's why I enjoy doing this show, because beer is so much more than just something you take out of the fridge while watching a movie. There's so many beautiful artistic things about beer. You get all the different styles and all the different methods, and then the history and interesting shoot-offs like this with monks making beer. It's like there's a massive world out there, and you can take a moment, sit back and learn a bit about it and try some different things, learn about it. Then you learn how to taste and you learn how to look and you learn how to experience. It's such a wonderful thing.
You know, and in my opinion, one of the best ways to experience the big, beautiful world that we live in is drinking it.
Mm-hmm. Well, with that, that's a good point to end on. So we'll continue drinking our beers and you guys continue listening, please, and trying new things, expanding your horizons, visiting breweries, going to your liquor store, wherever, find something different, looks different, give it a shot. You're only out a few bucks. So until next time.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The Ambibulous is made possible with Castos, giving creators the tools to connect with their audience and community. The music is courteous of Pond 5, with over 25 million royalty-free stock videos, music, photos, and sound effects. There's something for every creator. I would like to thank Dylan Schaefer for the use of his facility and time to create this episode. Today's content was recorded here at Dialectic Brewing Company in Mandan, North Dakota. For the latest updates, videos, photos, and web links to our guests, please consider checking out our Facebook page, The Ambibulous Podcast. And of course, a big thank you to all our listeners. Thank you for all of your support. Until next time, cheers. Until next time, cheers.